All right, good morning, guys. It is,
Morning.
let is, what is it? It is Monday, the 24th of March, 2025. Pete, what's the number?
Solder smoke 258. Crank it in, Ralph. Crank it in, Robert.
You know, we got to explain the crank it in business because there are people who have gaps in their solder smoke experience. So, Pete, why don't you explain what crank it in means?
Well, first, this is a long time ago. You got an input from Ralph, and Ralph said, "I like to listen to solder smoke, but I don't know what number it is. So sometimes I'll crank it in, and I got the wrong number because it's one I've already listened to. So please crank in the right number." So that's why the 258. And then, as we found out, there was a solder smoke podcast listener had a young son. Really young. He sat on his lap and he loved to listen to solder smoke. So his name was Robert. So that's why we said, "Okay, Ralph, crank it in. Crank in the right number."
All right,
And
guys.
Robert, crank it in.
All right, we're cranked
So
in.
let me make a confession. I never knew what that was about. I thought it was some relationship to the old honeymooners or something. I don't know.
Well, I'm glad we got that clarified. I thank Tony
Oh.
Fishpool in the UK, who said to me, "I don't know what the crank it in thing means." All right, he figured it was some sort of Americanism, I guess.
So did I.
Crank it in, Robert. Crank it in, Ralph.
Hey, but listen, on a serious note, we have to start with something that's serious. Pete, we're very sorry to hear about the loss of your wife. And I know everybody in the solder smoke community will join us in sending condolences to you and to your family, to your many kids. It just we're very sorry about it. And we know it's a tough time for you, so we really appreciate you taking the time to come back here on solder smoke. And the only thing I could say is that we hope that ham radio will, for you, be kind of a distraction from your loss. And it's a distraction from life's difficulties for many of us. So we hope that you could find some sort of solace and shelter here in the Solder Smoke podcast.
Well, thank you, Bill. And I wanted to thank all of the podcast listeners who sent me emails and cards. It was most comforting. You never realize how many people you talk to until you start getting all these emails, and it's really amazing. But you also must never lose your sense of humor. And that's really important because that carries you through. And I just want to share a small thing as we were making final preparations and put her to rest. The cemetery people had me sign a document. They said, "Okay, you got to read this document. You got to sign this document." I said, "All right." So it was 12 items. It says, "You will not do this." And the first was, "You will not have a mariachi band at the gravesite during the interment." During the interment. So I said, "Okay." "And you will not have a picnic at the gravesite." And I said, "Okay." I mean, these things just sound like things you would not, never do, never do. So come the day of the funeral, there's another burial taking place. And guess what? There's a mariachi band complete with a tuba. You never lose your sense of humor. I said, "Okay." But I guess it's like New Orleans, the jazz band going down the street.
Hey, Pete, you want to move your mic down? You might want to move your
Yeah.
mic down a little bit.
Okay. Is
That's
that
better.
better?
That's better. I think it's better. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, but we got you, I'm sure. All right. Dean, do you have any comments?
No, just to echo what you said, you and I have been corresponding for 4 or 5 years now, and I understand how tough the experience is. I lost my parents kind of at the beginning of when we were talking. That's kind of what got me into ham radio in the first place, actually, being with my dad. So I really feel for your experience. I can both sympathize and empathize with everything you're going through, both before and after, because the bureaucracy of death is no fun. It's just crazy.
But anyway, Pete, we're real sorry,
Thank you.
and thanks
Thank
for
you
your
very
comments,
much.
Dean. Hey, but let's get on with it. Let's get back into the solder smoke world, which is a kind of an artificial world where we're kind of protected from life's realities. But here we are, and I would just start with a little bit of travelogue because I just recently, as the viewers in the solder smoke video world can see, I am back in my shack in Northern Virginia. Back from the DR, we were in the DR from like 16 December to about 18 March. We skipped the winter in the north, and we were down in Solder Smoke Shack South. I'm trying to get an HI7 call. I want to be HI7 something because I found that HI7 stroke N2CQR confuses a lot of people. It confuses them in CW. It confuses them in single sideband. You get a lot of what? Where are you located? What's that? All right. So I'm going to try to skip over that. I'm trying to get a real HI7 call. We're working on it. Hey, on this trip, as part of the travel log, lots of science and nature. Science and nature. Some of it good, some of it not so good. First, we had an earthquake, 5.9. 5.9 in the middle of the night. It was like 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning. Woke us up. That thing was rocking and rolling, especially if you're up on the sixth or seventh floor of an apartment house. The thing is going like that. It's like somebody's at the bottom of the bed shaking the bed. So that was pretty interesting. We watched a Falcon 9 launch about 20 minutes before the thing took off. Elisa looks at her phone and sees Instagram and says, "Wait a second, this thing's going to fly over the Dominican Republic." So I did a quick calculation. I got SpaceX on my iPhone, and sure enough, they were going to launch a Falcon 9 rocket out of Cape Canaveral. And it was going to fly directly over the Dominican Republic. So I figured, okay, where is it going to be? I checked on my watch, which has a compass in it. It's going to be coming. We should look to the northwest. And we're all out there on the porch. And then, bang, man, this thing flew over. It still had the main engines going. It was amazing. Some people thought that it would be like sort of like a meteor, like a flash, like a second or two most. No. This thing was up there for a long time, and I have a picture on the show notes, and I'll post a I'll, I think I did post a video. You can take a look at it. We had one definite, two possible Starlink deorbits. And during the month of January, they deorbited about 120 satellites. So a lot of these things were coming down, and Dean and I were talking about this. We thought at first that it was just a bolide, a big meteor, right? But then again, I've been looking at the skies now for 30 years, and I've seen maybe one of these maybe 30 years ago. So for Elisa and I to both see two of them in the space of a month was a little bit kind of too coincidental, I think. So we think that what we actually saw was Starlink satellites coming down. They turn green, and sure enough, one of the websites says that green is the sign of magnesium burning. And a lot of the satellite is made up of magnesium. So we saw they were pretty spectacular. One especially was pretty amazing. We went out and saw whales because it's whale season in the Dominican Republic. The whales that they have in the DR come to one particular bay called Samaná Bay, and they come during these months. They come for two purposes. One is to give birth to the new calves. Second is to mate. And so they come down here for that purpose. And after that, they all head north. They head north for the summer, and they end up in the area around Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Now, we've been on whale hunting there, and we've seen the whales, and the whale watcher people on the boat said, "Oh, yeah, they're from the Dominican Republic." And we said, "Yeah, us too." So there was a connection, and we saw the whales. There's hawks. We saw hawks. There's one particular endangered kind of hawk down there called the Gavilán Española, which is the Dominican hawk or Ridgway's hawk. We think we saw it. We may have seen one. I learned to fly a drone. I never flew a drone before. We had a drone down there. I flew a drone. I am a drone pilot, and I'm going to get another one. It's almost too easy. It's really easy. I'm going to put some pictures on the Patreon. We had a total lunar eclipse we saw. That was pretty cool. I set up a 10-meter CW beacon with an LED, and all of that thanks to WN2A, Mike. He was the one who sent me the keyer to get the beacon going. And the transmitter itself was something I built probably 25 years ago. And not only, here's this thing. I set up an LED with the beacon. and you could put the LED in the window. So Elisa and I would go out and walk the dog at night. I'd look up, I'd say, look, there's the light in my shack. Beep, 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 going off in Morse code. About a week after we put it up there, one of the neighbors came and said, hey, I was walking in the neighborhood and there's some sort of green light coming from your Radio Shack up on the roof. I said, yes, do not be disturbed.
So Bill, when you first set up your beacon, I was the first one to copy it with my S-Bidex, my homebrew S-Bidex. Now, I don't copy CW, except everybody knows CQ, and Bill's call has CQ right in the middle of it, so I could hear it. And I said, I'll bet that's Bill. And I turned on the CW skimmer on the S-Bidex, and I was able to copy his caller. He even included his email address at Yahoo, so I could write to him and say, Bill, I heard you.
It was so cool. Thank you for doing that, Dean. Because you set up one of these beacons and you think, I don't know if anybody's hearing this thing. I don't know. It's 3 watts out to a quarter wave vertical, and Dean was able to pick it up all the way in Northern Virginia. So thanks very much for doing that. And thanks to Mike, AWN2A, who sent us the ideas, who sent us the keyer with all that information in it. There's a lot of shortwave listeners around the world who specialize in CW beacons on 10 meters. I've been getting reports from them because we put the email address in the message. So the email address is I'm sorry, n2cqr at yahoo.com. And I've got several reports there. One guy actually from Holland sent an audio recording of his reception of the beacon in Holland, which is pretty good. We met lots of great people. It's good to be back, but I'm planning for a better antenna. I have to have a better antenna down there. Dean and I have hex beams here. It's amazing. It's amazing what you could do with a hex beam. But hey, let's switch. Let's turn it over. Dean, Pete, you've got the SI-5351 and a Raspberry Pi behind you there on the screen. So tell us about what's going on at N6QW, the Newberry Park
Well,
Laboratory.
as you said, Bill, this currently now I have a little more time to work on some things, and this had been an idea in the back of my mind. I have a few homebrew SDR transceivers, and they relied on this little circuit board that came from SDR LLC in the UK. It was originally a part of the project QRP 2000. And what that essentially does is interface between the QuIST SDR software and your transceiver, and it controls the frequency. So as you tune the QuIST, the frequency of the radio tunes, it also has a control function. When you hit the push to talk button, it goes into transmit. You can no longer get these boards. So if you want to build anything new, you had this problem. How do you interface between the QuIST software and the SDR transceiver? So I've had this idea about a minimalist homebrew SDR transceiver, MHST. That's the acronym stands for minimalist. What's the minimum you can get away with? I mean, there's some very sophisticated projects out there, including the one from Jack Purdom. You've seen that rig, and of course the S-Bidex. They're a multi-band, whatever have you. I'm trying to build something that's really simple, and something that you could build, believe it or not, Manhattan style. Many of these very sophisticated devices use FPGA, so you need a circuit board because you can't put that on a Manhattan. You got to do something. So the goal was something simple, but I had this gap between the QuIST software and between the transceiver itself. And enter the Vienna Wireless Society's SDR receiver project, which uses a Raspberry Pi Pico. Very inexpensive board. I bought one for $7 off of Amazon. I said, boy, if we could get this thing to work, this would be the answer to the problem of interfacing between the QuIST software and my minimalist transceiver. And working with Dean, I was able to get access to the software and the circuit diagram. And I had a little problem actually getting it to work, but I did. Now, there's two systems that you can use with QuIST. One is a Windows system, the other is a Linux. I'm more familiar with the Linux because I built a lot of radios that use the Linux software of QuIST, and it's pretty easy to implement. And they have a special software package that you dump into the QuIST directory and says, okay, now instead of looking at a Hermes light or some other type of SDR Micron or AC IRQ, we're going to look at the Vienna Wireless Society package. I was not able to get that to work in Linux. You dump it into the QUIST directory, and when you list up the call already, the menu of radios, you should be able to find the one that says VWS. Somehow, it just does not show up in the QUIST directory when you're using Linux. I installed it on a Windows 10 machine. There it is. It works. So I had some problems to solve, and one of the problems was it's very sensitive to what the particular VWS package asks you for a COM port. They have a default COM5. It never clicked in my mind that COM5 is generic. So finally I said, you know, that must be the problem. So actually using the Arduino IDE, you can find out what COM port it is, because that's how you have to load it. And it says, by the way, that COM5 is COM21, not
Hey
COM5.
Pete, hey Pete,
Yes.
guess what COM port on my laptop is connected to the USB dongle?
Five? So you didn't have that problem. You didn't have that problem.
That's where the five came from.
Oh,
I,
okay.
so, so I did the Windows interface for the QUIST software, and originally, in Unix, it's, TTYA, whatever. Yeah, well, I needed to make it work with Windows, and I said, well, what COM port am I on? So I just plugged in COM5 there. But in the QUISC software, there's a configuration menu where you pick it. So pick that, and you pick your audio in and out.
So I picked 20, I put 20, 21 in there to work. Then we had a few other issues, like the VWS software is set up for a receiver. So I want to use it for transceivers. So there's still some work, but something that I think maybe I'm overlooking, and I just share this with you, and maybe Dean, you have some answer in this. When I use the Cixiao RP2040, and you were writing the Arduino sketch, normally in the Arduino sketch, you just say two, three, four, whatever the designation in the Arduino IDE, like two and three are typically the encoder, but those are actually not the pin numbers on the Arduino. In the RP2040, you got to put the actual pin numbers. You can't say pins two, three, or five. You have to say 28U. And I suspect that that's the same problem with the Pico. I've been trying to track that down. You can't just say pin four. You have to say GP2. So I think that's the reason I can't get it to transmit. In other words, it'll go into transmit, but I have to trigger the TR relay. So that's the thing I'm working on. Yesterday, I had a disaster. Everything died. And I couldn't get it to work. And I says, okay, this is one of those classic things. When it dies big time. And what had happened to not cause it to work right, I had plugged the USB connection into the Raspberry Pi Pico into any slot into the USB and the four USB connectors in the front of the computer. And I didn't think. They're not all RP21, or they're not all COM21. So I had it was not functioning. So then I says, you know what? I bet you I have to put it in the one. And I found out by using the Arduino IDE that only one of the four recognized COM21. So it was an error on my part. So I had to get the right USB port. And the other thing is I had a bad ADE1. So now it's all back working again. So anyway, it's been fun. I've got it working on receive, and I even had a interesting situation where one of the AD1s was shot because when you called up the spectrum display, you were getting double sideband. So I says, "Uh-oh, I'm missing one of the detectors." So I replaced that, and that's all working again. But I'm kind of excited about being able to use what was developed by Oliver KI3P. Some really great software, and this could be huge. It could be applicable aside from what is happening with the Wireless Society's SDR receiver. I mean, this could be generally applied to guys who say, okay, now how do I interface between the two? So it's been kind of exciting. Now I got it working again. I want to try to get it working in transmit, and get the thing on the air. But anyway, it's really, really amazing. And I think the biggest feature, I paid $7.58 for the Pi Pico on Amazon. So, I mean, technology, this powerful technology, cheap. And actually, when you build the device, aside from the, you have a bo you're having a board made, is that correct for the receiver project?
Yeah, we have the board. We actually have the boards made, and I built the prototype. That's why I did
Yeah.
the Windows interface, because most of our guys have Windows. They don't have Linux. It actually works on Linux, Pete. So I'll get the guy who did Linux to
Yeah,
contact you.
I need to figure that out, because I did the same thing. I dumped the package into the Quisk directory, and it shows up in the Windows, but it doesn't show up in the Linux. So
This is why Bill loves software.
I hope you guys know that I'm being discreetly quiet during all of this. I'm just sitting here.
So, so, so on my screen here, we have Mr. Analog at the top of the screen. I'm
That's
in the
me.
middle, and we have Mr. Digital at the bottom of the screen. See? So I'm if you've ever seen Severance, where you're bifurcated into two halves, I'm in both worlds.
There you go. So anyway, I'm really excited about getting this to work. And again, cost issue. I can see just there was two power supplies you had to add to it, a 5 volt and a 3.3 volt, and the SI5351. So believe it or not, $20 total buys you everything you need to build that interface. And I mean, that's, you can't even get a McDonald's for that anymore, you know, so that's really good. The other little thing I'm working on, believe it or not, in the last couple of weeks, I've had some serious earthquakes 10 miles from my home. One registered 4.1, the other 3.9, and they're to the south east of me. Kind of just north of Malibu, right over Calabasas. So all those movie star guys that moved from Hollywood to Calabasas are now in the zone. So, but it's pretty dramatic. And the thing that's interesting about the earthquakes, they're just a sharp spike, and it's a very short duration. It's not one of the rolling ones, you know, that go on and on and on. So, but you know that they've been there, and you worry about those sharp spikes, because that disconnects the pipes underground, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm thinking about, I said, you know, maybe I need a seismograph here. So I found a little project, and Bill sent me a link on a project about home brewing a seismograph. It'd be kind of interesting just to see. And the cost of the parts, it's an Arduino, an OLED display, and it's essentially a vibration detector. So that's another project on the list. This is getting real serious. And Bill, you were talking about the 5.9 magnitude earthquake you experienced in the DR. I want to share an earthquake story with you from a long, long time ago, about 1967. And I had just got out of the Navy, and I went to work for AT&T Long Lines in San Francisco. And we were in a building right next to the Palace Hotel, right down in the financial district. And the AT&T offices that I worked in were on the 11th floor of this building. So in those days, they actually had elevator operators. I mean, it wasn't on a cell service. There was someone in a little uniform that ran you up there. So it was a Monday morning after a nice party weekend in San Francisco, and I had a little too much to drink, so I wasn't the sharpest ever. So we got into the elevator, and as we're going up, I got really dizzy, and I said, "Man," I said, "I must have had more fun than I realized over the weekend." And the operator says, "No, that's an earthquake. It was shaking. It was sh shaking the elevator, and you had no visual reference. In other words, you couldn't see out the window and things moving. It's just you felt this lightheaded."
Sometimes the aftershocks will make you feel a little bit like seasick, like a little bit. But Dean was in the big one. Dean was in the big one. Tell us about that, Dean.
Two of them.
Two
Two
big
of them.
ones. This from
1971, I was 11 years old, and the Sylmar quake in Southern California was 6.4. 64 people died. The freeway fell down. The San Fernando Valley was threatened to be flooded because the Van Norman Dam, which supplies the water to the area, was going to breach. We got evacuated. Six of us and the dogs went to live in grandma's two-bedroom house for 2 weeks while we were evacuated. Fast forward 1994, I lived 3 miles from the epicenter of the Northridge earthquake, 4:31 in the morning, 6.9, I believe, and it felt like a giant was picking up the house and banging it on the ground. Everything fell out, brick walls fell down, water heater fell off the wall. You talk about pipes breaking, water main broke. I ran around all the neighbors and turned off their gas lines. It was so I know about earthquakes. I had post-earthquake traumatic stress syndrome for years. Every time, like I'd hear like that low rumble of a big truck going by, I'd want to dive for cover. Yeah. So yeah, earthquakes are no fun.
I was in a 6.2 one time in El Salvador, and it knocked me down. I was walking along on the inside of a military barracks, and it hit. It sounded like a freight train was right outside the building, and the next thing I knew was I was on the ground. And by the time I got up, it was over. But I was thinking, Pete, you definitely need a seismograph. You definitely need one. And I hope that that reference that I sent you, by the way, our listeners will want to know what it is. It's from the book called The Amateur Scientist by C.L. Stong. And I looked at the table of contents before I sent you this. There are three articles in there, three chapters on amateur seismology. So I'm sure, I mean, the book, it's really old. The technology has undoubtedly advanced quite a bit, but there's probably some good ideas in there in C.L. Stong's book. So good luck with that. And yes, you definitely need one. I think so.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I was thinking about doing this a couple of years ago. We had a little earthquake activity, and believe it or not, the sensor that they were using in this one was an old speaker, a 10-inch speaker that you buried in the ground because the vibrations will move that speaker and it generates a signal. So I was looking around for a 10-inch speaker that I got to bury in the ground. Got to get one with a plastic cone. Plastic cone so it'd be waterproof.
I on a similar note, the technology gets really cheap. You can get a really cheap Geiger counter now.
Yeah, oh yeah,
I
there
want one.
you
I want one that'll detect those alpha particles. Yeah.
there you go. Anyway, that's what's going on here. But you're right, Dean. You made a comment. The administrivia, I just cannot believe my days are consumed with paperwork. A tremendous amount of paperwork and things that you got to do that you do for convenience, like magazine subscriptions that are on autopay that automatically get charged. You ever try to get those turned off?
Oh man, forget it. No, you can't do it. You're in for life. That's
Yeah, you got it. You
it.
got
Pete, I think you're going to be reading Ladies' Home Journal for the rest of your life. Get
it.
into it, Pete. Get into it.
You got it.
Hey,
That's
speaking of
it,
which,
Bill.
what do we what Pete, what's the what is it that I always forget? I always forget to do, and you always remind me.
Shameless Commerce
Here we
Division.
are, Shameless Commerce Division. And I'll just say on this that look, please continue to use the Amazon link on the right. We like those Bezos book bucks coming in, and he sends it to us. Also, be sure to visit the site of Mostly DIY RF up there in the Silicon Forest in near Portland, Oregon. Our friend Todd is doing a terrific job putting out parts and boards and kits and everything else. So take a look at Mostly DIY RF. You'll see it on the right-hand side of the Solder Smoke blog. Also, please consider becoming a Patreon sponsor of Solder Smoke. That has become increasingly important. You know, people have asked what's happening to the blog and what's happening to the podcast, because we have noted in recent episodes there's been a decline in readership and listenership. And we notice this not only in the stats, but also in the number of comments that you see below each article. This is sort of a rough gauge of how much interest there is. We used to put up a blog post and automatically there'd be two, three, four, five comments. Now, most of the time you put up a blog post and there's crickets, you know? So it's disturbing. And a lot of us have been trying to figure out what's going on. I heard something the other night on a podcast that sort of explains what's going on. There's a guy, Fraser Cain. He does an interesting podcast called Universe Today, and he has been experiencing the same kind of decline in readership and listenership to his podcast. And he actually talks about it quite a bit. He talks about kind of being trapped in the algorithm. So in other words, in the past, it wasn't so much that you had to please the algorithm, but now the algorithm is everything. So we'll notice, for example, that some of our podcast or video post, even the YouTube algorithm, we'll do a YouTube video, put it out, and there'll be thousands of responses to it. Very similar video a week or so later will go out, similar time, similar subject, similar duration, and there'll maybe be 100. So there's something strange going on with the algorithms. And I suggest you just, if anybody's interested in this stuff, take a listen to Fraser Cain. I've got a link up in the show notes. But he thinks that Patreon will be the answer for him. I hope so. And it certainly will help us. So we don't obviously don't depend on this for our livelihood. So we're in a different situation than poor Fraser. But it is interesting to see from a technological perspective the influence of the algorithms and the interest and the influence of big tech on things that used to be small tech, like podcasts and blogs and everything else. So here we are. What do you think, Dean?
I think also that compelling content is helpful. I'll just point out, Bill, that when I put the first video up on the DCR challenge, we got 9,000 views. We're in Taylor Swift a popularity in the ham radio world here.
I know, man. You're like Taylor Swift, Ariana Grande, right here.
The algorithmic selection is really, I mean, we all see it. If you go on YouTube, they decide what to show you. You go on Facebook, it decides what to show you. No matter how you try and narrow it down so they don't do that, they still do it. So it's tough. And I also think that there are way more sites and podcasts and YouTube videos. I mean, when you started this in 2005, six, Bill, I gotta assume you were the only ham radio podcast that was regular, right? So
I remember when we didn't know what a podcast was, and I all of a sudden started seeing on the buses in London people with these little white things in their ear, and I said to Mike KL7R, I said, Mike, what is all that about? And around that time, a magazine article came out in the UK publication New Scientist. And it's called The Podcast Stole the Radio Store, or something like that, a play on the old rock and roll lyric. And it was about this new thing called podcasts. I told Mike about it, and he just hit the record button on VocalTech that we were using, and that became Solder Smoke One. But anyway, you're right. It's been a long time.
So,
And there was a lot more
I
competition.
mean, here's how quick technology changes. Apple doesn't even make a pod anymore, an iPod, an AirPod. They don't make them anymore, right?
I
Because
know.
they moved on to cell phones and everything else, right?
But the
And
word has persisted.
it has.
All right, but anyway, take a listen to the video, to the podcast about by Fraser Crane. I think so you'll find it illuminating. Hey, but Dean mentions something that we want to talk about now, and that's the lessons that we've learned from the Solder Smoke Direct Conversion Receiver Challenge Project. It's been really successful. Dean mentions the 8,000 views we got. His video,
9,000. We're up to 9,000. Just
9,000 views. He made a series of videos because I just sort of flippantly threw out the challenge. And then he followed up a couple of podcasts ago back in January. He said, I pledge to make videos to show people how to build all four of the boards. He supplemented that with several others. And then to answer all questions that may come up. We didn't realize at the time that this would turn into pretty much a full-time occupation, but it's been fun. And the results have really been very, very encouraging. We've got 45 successful builds. Now, when you compare that to 9,000 visits to the site, there's 45 people around the world have taken the time and a lot of trouble to build this receiver. They've learned a lot in the process. The feedback that we've been getting has been really fantastic. And if everybody who completes the receiver and who sends us proof of
Proof of
life,
life, yeah, we
proof of
gotta have
life,
that.
this was Dean's logic, that the receiver is actually inhaling single sideband and CW signals, gets placed in what we call the Hall of Fame. And we have about 45 entries right now. All of them go up on the Solder Smoke blog. There's a link. I've got a link in the show notes. You can click on it and see all of them.
Well, Bill, we got a lot of grief for being kind of doctrinaire about our build,
We
because
were.
people want to, well, we built Shure Radio, but we used a different, tuner. We used a different audio amp, but I couldn't, it was very expensive to get that $6 or $4 transformer, and I had to pay shipping. So I did something different. And so one of the reasons we asked for the video is that we could see if anybody actually built the radio that we designed or if they built something different. And Bill created a category called honorable mentions for those that completed a direct conversion receiver but didn't quite, follow the rules. And we got four or five of those too.
Yeah, and do it, but they, yeah, I think that it was a good compromise because we didn't want to completely scorn them because they built a receiver, they built a direct conversion receiver.
And they homebrewed it, and they did a lot of things that homebrewers do, which is, I don't have that part, I'm going to come up with a substitute.
That's right. So that was, it is honorable mention, and the emphasis is on honorable. They made an honorable effort. We got a lot of good feedback too by people who said they were surprised that they found the parts acquisition educational. It was useful for them to go out and try to obtain the parts to put it in their receivers. And even more common was the comment that people said that they really appreciated, as they went through the project, the difference between a kit build and a homebrew. This was a homebrew radio. We did not want to make it a kit. We did not want to send somebody a little baggie with a whole bunch of parts. I mean, that's fine. That's okay, but it's different. It's different when you say, look, you're going to scratch build it. You're going to acquire the parts. You're going to make the boards. You're going to do Manhattan style. And you're going to put it together so that when this thing is done, you're going to be able to look at it and say, I built this. One of the things, Dean made the comment that he assembled two IKEA shelves, but that doesn't make him a carpenter, right? And I made the comment that for years, Hams and others assembled Heathkits, Heathkit HW101, Heathkit DX60, Heathkit DX40. Nobody in the history of radio finished building the HW101 and turned to their mother and said, Mom, I just homebrewed a radio. No, you assembled a Heathkit, dude. That's different. It's just different. And so we wanted this to be a homebrew project. And it turned out that way. The other thing I would point out is that one of the things we insisted on was the use of homebrew circuit boards. Farhan was the one who told us that there are really just four circuits that you need to understand to master almost all of radio. There is the amplifier, the oscillator, the mixer, and the filter. All four of them were used in this project. But the other thing we said was we wanted to show people how to use the Manhattan technique, which is one of the easiest and fastest ways to build a circuit board. We got a lot of good comments from people who said, I never built anything Manhattan before, but this has really opened my eyes and I can see why this is a good way to prototype or to final build a piece of gear. One of the people who kind of criticized us early on criticized us because we were using the copper clad boards. I'd like to report that we've got almost 50 of these things built right now, all of them on copper clad boards. And what's the body count, Dean?
I think it's close to zero.
Zero. So we've got
close to zero,
zero fatalities in this thing so far.
So the concern was that the fiberglass and the boards, if you're cutting them up with snips, you can inhale it. And, all true. You don't want to be breathing in fiberglass, but the risks for what we do are so de minimis to be kind of, in my view, not worth even thinking about.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're right. And plus, I mean, even the SEM1 boards, I use SEM1 boards because of Pete's recommendation. And they fracture, they fall apart a lot less than the FR4 boards. So I think there's even less fiberglass dust floating around.
Yeah.
And you got the meat pads as an alternative. You don't even have to cut
pads,
them.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's it. So I think this project has been great. It's opened people's eyes to what you could do with homebrew. And one of the things I think that's most encouraging was that after we insisted that people build it the way we designed it and not build some exotic different version of it, once they get it done, then of course all bets are off and you can do whatever you want. That's the great thing about homebrew. And a lot of people are adopting kind of new homebrew styles. One of the things I've been really interested in is that for many of them, a double sideband transmitter to go along with the direct conversion receiver, it has been sort of the natural follow-on. And we've got several guys who've already built these things. And that it's really encouraging to see that kind of progress and innovation going forward. So anyway.
It is, and I think there's a couple other things. When I decided I was going to do this as an internet challenge, and we talked about it, I think in December, I was thinking about, oh, how am I going to arrange this? What kind of vehicle are we going to use to communicate with? And originally, I set up a Google Groups email. I thought, well, I'll do it with Google Groups, or I thought maybe a Groups.io, but then Groups.io charges you if you get too many people in there. Discord is a very common platform for that started in the gaming world for people to interact with each other, and it has kind of a lot of the features you want for a community like this. So I created a Discord server for us. We've invited everybody to join it. It'll be on the show notes here. It's on most of the posts we put on the Solder Smoke blog, and we now have close to 500 people participating in our Discord group. We originally set it up just for the direct conversion receiver, but now we have channels for, all kinds of homebrew things, oscilloscopes and tube rigs. We got one guy who's building a tube rig now. So it's become a really interesting place to be. But as Bill said, we kind of got into this full-time job for about 6 weeks of being the electronics coaches for the internet. And that's a bit of a challenge. I wrote to Alan Wolke, and he said, "Well, welcome to my world." So yeah,
Yeah.
it's been interesting.
One of the things that one of the most interesting things about it is the worldwide reach of the Discord channel and the internet in general. And we Dean and I, when we started this, I remember we talked, we said, well, how many of these receivers do you think they're going to actually build? And
I
Dean
said
said,
12.
maybe 12. We're up to 50 now, and there'll probably be a lot more to come. But the audience, the people who are building this thing, it really is a worldwide effort. And I just off the top of my head, of course, a lot of US builders, a few Canadians, a lot of UK builders, a number of builders in Holland, in the Netherlands, one guy in Indonesia, in Bali, has built the rig successfully. Several guys in New Zealand, several guys in Australia, including Tasmania, and Ramakrishnan in India is working on the rig also. And a lot of this we drew a lot of inspiration from Wes W7ZOI's original November 1968 solid state direct conversion receiver. And also a lot of this was launched by Farhan's effort to assist the girls' schools in and around Hyderabad. So it's
So Bill, we have had great uptake worldwide. It's been really gratifying, but we would be remiss if we did not mention those who are missing in action in our direct conversion receiver build. I don't want to create a internecine podcast war,
But you've started it,
but
Dean, but you've started it.
however, comma, we did challenge you did go on the Ham Radio Workbench podcast and challenge the Workbench guys to build it. As far as I know, nobody on the Workbench has built a receiver yet, but.
I look occasionally with hope. I look at our brothers at the Ham Radio Workbench. I go to their Discord channel, and they have a subheading there called Solder Smoke Challenge. Crickets. There's nothing there. So the challenge remains open, by the way. There's no time frame, no time period on it, anything like that. And we look forward to people
Well,
from other areas.
let me kind of put an asterisk. The challenge is open, but I'm not spending 24 hours a day coaching the build. But
No,
there's
of course not.
lots of folks on there will help. All the videos are up, all the instructional materials, testing procedures, it's all there.
It's everything is still there, so you go for it. And there's a lot of really smart people on the Discord channel now who have the experience of having built this thing successfully, and they're now in a good position to advise on how to do it. So yeah, so go for it. I think it's a fun project, and the thing really works too. The amazing thing is that I think people are surprised when they put it together, and all of a sudden there's voices coming out of this thing. There's SSB contacts. People have hooked it up to FT, hook up to the computer and decode FT8 with their phones. They can listen to CW. One of the guys, W4KAC, he is actually one of the guys whose call sign is written on the ET2 transceiver that I built back in 2019. I made a contact with him using that thing. So it's great. A number of people have built several of them and given them to their friends or had their friends build them along with them. So it's been a really gratifying project. And Dean, I want to thank you for making the extra effort to make a lot of this happen. I mean, just the videos are just the your videos. I people said that Dean should be nominated for some form of Academy Award for video production in support of amateur radio home brew.
If I'm an amateur home brewer, I'm also an amateur video maker. But a little bit effort. No fancy fly-in titles or music. Just just the facts, man.
It was nice. It was good. Anyway, anything else on the direct conversion receive build project?
No, I'm just really gratified that we've had so much enthusiasm. And while our community of home brewers, we've talked about this before, is small, it is a dedicated community and an enthusiastic community. And the podcast, the YouTube videos, Solder Smoke, Ham Radio Workbench, all of the other guys that are involved in amateur radio, social media, help bring our community together. We have this worldwide community. Think about the fact that we have guys as far away as Bali building this stuff, and they're communicating with the guys that developed it. When I started doing this stuff, I found you guys, I found Pete, I found Bill, started communicating. And that's one of the beauties of amateur radio homebrew building today, is you actually get access to the people who designed the thing. And most of us are fairly friendly. When you send us an email or a note, we respond.
That's it. All right. Dean, move right out to your bench, because other than I know the direct conversion receiver project has been taking up a lot of time for the last, certainly during February and early March, but you've also got other projects going. And I detect other transceivers. Pete, we have a rival for the record of how many SSB transceivers, and he's sitting right there in front of us.
We're working not only transceivers but receivers, right? So the first one was, Pete mentioned the Vienna Wireless Society. I run the makers group for the Vienna Wireless Society, and Oliver, a K3IP, volunteered to run this project for us, where he has taken us through how to design and fabricate a surface mount PCB. And then coming up in a few weeks, we're going to do a build day, and people are going to build these things. Everybody's going to home brew, or not home brew, they're going to home solder these little surface mount 1206 surface mount parts on the board, and they'll have working SDR receivers. Oliver is the guy who works with Jack Purdom on the T41, and he's basically done the design for all the kit boards that they're selling for there. So he took a portion of that T41 project. We slimmed it down and made it just the analog receiver part for the SDR. He took us through KiCad, circuit diagram layout and fabrication, and then we ordered the boards. I built one of the first prototypes because I'd never built an SDR. I'd never built an S surface mount board before, and so being able to do that was interesting for me. And I learned kind of what soldering iron tip you got to use for 1206 parts. 1206 parts are small, but they're not so small that you can't do them. I did wear some magnifying glasses. Use tweezers to hold the part, put a little solder on one pad, slide the part on with a solder melted, and it mostly worked. I had a few of them that were tombstoned up in the air. I actually tried to kind of get them flat and put too much force on. I actually broke two of the capacitors. So I learned that, all right, you really just have to be careful and slow. But it was an interesting experience. Then getting the QISC software going, I did the Windows version. And then Pete asked me, well, can you turn on a button on PTT? So I did that little mod for Pete. But that's been interesting. But I haven't done anything between the direct conversion receiver project, which we've been working on for over 2 years now, given the high school and then this. I was just aching to build something of my own. And a few months ago, Pete, you had sent me a link to one of these Yaesu VFOs, $35 on eBay, which is good. You gotta be careful. Some guys will charge like 80 or 100 bucks for the VFO, but if you're patient, you can find one. And it's been sitting there staring at me, begging me to build, challenging me to build something. So, in a fit of what Bill calls spontaneous construction, over the last couple of weeks, I have built a 20 meter. I have the receiver built and the transceiver is all laid out. It uses the 9 megahertz VFO. I had to first figure out what wires go where and how to make it work, but it fired right up. It's not a FT101 VFO, it's an FT401 VFO. It operates at 9 volts, not 6 volts, which the other one did. I don't know what all the differences are. It seems to be pretty much the same circuit. It has the same controls and everything, but I guess it's a newer version of the VFO. I'm not sure, but it fired right up. It tunes across starting at 9 megahertz. As Bill found when he's built them, the output is too low to switch the mixers. So I put a homebrew TIA amplifier, the 3 transistor gain. You can set the gain by changing a couple of resistors. I put a 7 dB TIA in there, and it switches the mixer just fine. Now, having done this, I'm the baby homebrewer among the three of us, but I've been doing it for 5 or 6 years now, and I've been pretty busy building rigs, and I now have a box of boards that might be rigs, as Bill says. And so I pulled a diode ring mixer, one of the leftovers from the direct conversion receiver project. I ripped the diplexer off there because I don't need it, and I put it in, and suddenly I was mixing. I put in a signal from the signal generator, and I had the kind of first part of the receiver going. I had an audio amplifier from the simple SSB build, Pete, 2N3904 and LM386. I pulled that out of the box, put that down on the board. I got 4 TIA boards that were unpopulated from Todd, mostly DIYRF, that he sent me a couple of years ago, that were just sitting there waiting for me to plug the transistors in. A little bit of kilt building there, and I built the 4 amplifiers for the IF. That was kind of fun. I had a bandpass filter for 20 meters, but I put it on the Nano VNA, and this was probably the first one I built when I was building the simple SSB, Pete. And it was, now that I understand how to build them and I know how to look at it and I know how to measure it, I'm like, oh, that thing's terrible. I set it aside. I built a new one, beautiful bandpass filters, almost zero loss. It's great. That took me all of like 15 minutes, but it used to take me hours and hours to do. I can do it a few minutes now. I built a crystal filter. I bought 5 megahertz crystals from Mauser. And again, in a couple of hours, I used the Dischel software. I used the G3 UUR crystal tester that I had, evaluator that I had built when I was doing the SBIDx project. I built a quasi equal ripple bandpass filter. This is basically a cone filter that has an extra crystal on each end that reduces the ripple. And Bill gave me a little bit of advice about, setting the impedance with a couple of resistors until you kind of measure it. Actually, the Dischel software gave me the number for what it thought the input and output impedance was. And it turned out it was pretty spot on. So I built an LC filter on each end, put it in there. And so I had that done. Then I had to build something I'd never done before. I had to build an analog BFO. And so that was a new experience for me. Bill, as is often the case, suggests, "Oh, just look at the name your BIDx schematic." So this time I looked at the BIDx 20 schematic, and I just built the BFO out of there. It's a crystal oscillator. Pretty simple, easy to kind of move where you want it to. I built the two diode balanced modulator, and so it was pretty easy, and it went together kind of almost. This is why people will ask, "Well, where's the schematic?" There isn't one.
Where's the bomb, Dean? Dean, where's the bomb? The bomb.
There's no bomb. There's no. If I don't take notes, I won't remember. Last night, somebody asked me a question about the VFO, and I thought, well, I put an amplifier on there. What amplifier did I put on there? And I had to actually look at the board. I saw the three transistors. Oh yeah, I built a TIA.
I have to go back to the Solder Smoke blog.
So the delightful thing for me about this, and this almost never happens, but it's also a testament to what I learned from you guys, which is if you build in modules, if you test each module separately, when you hook it all up together, there's a high probability that it is going to fire up and work the first time. And in fact, it did. I was so delighted. I turned that thing on for the first time. I didn't have an antenna hooked up. I just put a 20 meter signal on the signal generator and set the leads down on there. And as I tuned through the band, whoo, started coming up. I was like, man, this is amazing. And then I plugged the antenna in. I immediately called Bill and said, I'm receiving on my new receiver. And then I put the Sanjian frequency counter on there, so I could actually see the glowing numerals, and realized, all right, I got to set the IF on that thing. So I set the IF. So now it's actually not showing 9 megahertz on the Sanjian; it's showing me the 20 meter. But as I was tuning up and down, I realized I was only getting up to 14.250, and then I hit the end of that tuning dial, and I was despairing. I was thinking, I have to go by. Bill had told me he used 5.2 megahertz crystals. I said, well, that would do it for me because I only use 5 megahertz crystals. But then Yaesu engineers from the distant past came to the rescue. There's an
They're wizards.
adjustment
They're
on the
wizards.
VFO. There's a cap, and you can tune it. And you don't even have to get into the bottom. I had it all screwed down to the board. There's an adjustment hole. So I put the screwdriver in there, turn the cap. Boop, I am now tuning across the entire 20 meter band. So it's been a lot of fun, and I'm very close to actually having the transmitter done, because I think I need to build a microphone amplifier. I have the actual power amplifier chain built. It's the same one I used in the SBIDx. In fact, it's version one of that one. So a couple more boards, and I will have a transceiver running. So spontaneous construction.
Excellent.
Hey, Dean, you know what struck me is you sent me the video, and as I looked at it, I said, I know how big this thing is because I know how big that VFO box is,
Yeah.
and it overwhelms. It's the biggest item on the board, so that is not very big. That's not a very big board.
it's enormous. The board is about 12 inches by 14 inches, something like that. I put copper tape down for my ground plane. It looks a lot like an N2CQR rig. So thank you for all of that,
Well,
Bill.
I think we need to thank somebody else, and that's Farhan, because when Farhan wrote the original BIDx 20 article many years ago, 15, 20 years ago, there was a line in there that really kind of resonated, no pun intended, resonated with me. And then he was talking about how you build the BIDx 20, and he got to the point where you are, Dean, where you just finished the receiver. And he said at this point, stop. Take the evening to just enjoy the receiver that you have just built by yourself. This is something that we heard from several of the homebrewers of the direct conversion receiver. They said that they were not building a transceiver, they were just building a receiver. But still, they took heed of what Farhan said and just spent some time just appreciating the fact that they had taken a bunch of parts, put them together, and created a machine that pulls in voices from the other side of the planet. It's pretty amazing.
It never ceases to be true either, Bill. I built the VWS SDR receiver, and as soon as I had that working and QISC set up, I spent 2 or 3 evenings just listening to sideband on that receiver, and it was delightful. In fact, it was the only thing I wanted to listen to for several days. And even our 40 meter direct conversion receiver, which I have built like seven of now. When I got the new one, I built a new one along with the videos because I had to demonstrate each board and video each. So I built a new receiver. And once I got that running, that became my receiver of choice
I know.
for several days.
You almost feel bad about putting it in a box because you get used to the al fresco look. You get you used to, you like seeing the circuitry sitting there in front of you. You think, I got to put this in a box and hide it
So
all.
I do have one. I'm gonna create a KK4 DAS direct contribution to this Yaesu VFO based transceiver, which is the VFO came with the original Yaesu panel that has two windows, one for the tuning dial and one for something else. And the something else is I'm going to build, using my own skills, I'm going to build an Arduino based frequency counter with a little TFT display, so I will
Oh,
have the
cool.
glowing numerals in there, and I won't be
Excellent.
using the Shenzhen, foreign country built, glowing numerals. I'll have my own glowing numerals.
All right. Excellent. Homebrew glowing numerals. All right. Excellent, Dean. Thanks very much. Dean, were you going to say something about the balloons?
Well, the other thing that's been consuming for the Vienna Wireless Society is we're going to do a balloon launch probably in the June timeframe. We are building a Raspberry Pi Pico based beacons that all, when everything is all put together, including these solar cell antennas, the whole thing weighs about 20 grams. You'll launch them with balloons that are kind of like the party balloons you get at the grocery store, but they're clear and we're not going to use helium. We're going to use hydrogen because that gets you more lift and gets you up higher. Some of the guys who have built early versions of these balloons have these things going all around the world. They put out a whisper a beacon first in the first transmission. They put out a whisper beacon with the normal whisper data. And then the second transmission, they encode in that data information about a height, altitude, and geolocation. It has a GPS chip on it. It's a very, very cool little project. So we'll be building those over the next couple of months, and then launching probably sometime in June. So look for the it'll be the one I'll be launching will be have a call sign K4XY. Kilo 4 X-ray Yankee, which is the Vienna Wireless Society call sign. So you'll be able to track that as it goes around the world.
I want to launch one from the Dominican Republic, so I'll be talking to you about this.
We
I've got some
have
plans.
plenty of components,
All
Bill.
right, there, we're gonna have to do that. All right, well, thanks a lot, Dean, and interesting stuff. I don't have too much to report from my bench because I've been moving from the other solder smoke shack south. But while I was down there, I continued my habit of listening to the old military radio net, which is a group that meets on 3885 on Saturday morning, early, 5 o'clock local on the East Coast, 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock Saturday morning. And I've been listening to them. And while I was in the Dominican Republic, I listened by web SDR. There's one in Pennsylvania that's quite useful. I also use NA5B's web SDR. He's right here in Springfield, Northern Virginia. He's a member of the VWS Club, Mehmet. But while I was doing it down there, I said to myself, when I get back home, I'm going to actually check in the real way, the old-fashioned way, the radio way. So I tuned up the DX100, the K2ZA I donated, gifted a receiver that John Zaruba gave me a while back, with my Hammerlin HQ100 and a dipole or doublet antenna up on the roof. And I checked into the old military radio net on Saturday. It was kind of interesting. It's fun to talk to those guys. I don't have any old military radios. I'm not really a military radio guy, but the DX100 is socially acceptable there. So they were very, very cordial, very, very nice. One guy on the old military radio net made a comment about what he saw at a recent Hamfest, and Dean, this probably backs up your experience with Winterfest. He was pointing out that the old boat anchor radios that used to be so cherished and so highly priced are now almost difficult to give away. He described at a Hamfest DX60s, DX60 transmitters from Heathkit that were, quote, stacked like cordwood, and that they were offering them as buy one and get one free.
Wow.
Wow. So, I mean, that's for me, that's kind of the shape of things to come.
Yeah, the Vienna Wireless Society has a group that will help SK families clean out the shacks and sell off the gear. And unfortunately, our storage unit is getting more full and rather than less full. And some of the gear is just hard to sell. I
It
mean,
is.
we're doing some stuff that is close to a giveaway. And I'll tell you, even for me, I wanted to restore a Hammerlin HQ170 because that was the receiver my dad had when I was growing up. So I bought one of those and I restored it. It's the biggest thing in my shack, and it's big and it's hot and it's heavy, and then it has this giant speaker on top of it, and I listen to it maybe once every 6 months, but I have no desire for another giant tube rig anywhere in the shack.
Well, one of the guys on the old military, I have the DX100. You can see it back there behind me, right there. I'm pointing to it. There's a DX100. There's a Hammerlin HQ100 above it. And one of the guys on the old military radio, and he wasn't talking about this particular rig. He said it would be interesting if you could check in to buy a radio from the Dominican Republic. And I said, well, it'd be tough to get that DX100 in my luggage. So that's probably out. But the other thing I've been doing, and Dean and I have talked about this since I've been back, I've really come to appreciate the hex beam that I have up on the roof here and that I don't have in the Dominican Republic. So I've discovered that early morning on 20 meters, early morning, like 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning here, it's open to the Pacific. And holy cow, I have now worked, get this, two different stations in Rarotonga. I never
Ooh.
even heard of Rarotonga before.
Oh,
It sounds
yeah.
like Rare DX, Rarotonga. There are apparently four ham radio stations on Rarotonga, and in the last week, I've talked to two of them. This means I'm approaching the Workdall Rarotonga Award. Think about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're halfway there. You're halfway there, Bill.
this makes me think that and these are really nice contacts too. It's not like 5'9", hello, goodbye. It's talking to this guy. One guy down there told me he was on Rarotonga for 53 years. He's a Scot. Jim, and the other
So
guy's a German who's down there.
Bill, if you
Yeah.
send me $10, I will print you up a Workdall, an official Workdall Rarotonga
I might
certificate
take you
that
up
you can
on
put on
that.
your wall.
Well, what's the call sign prefix of Rarotonga?
Echo 5-1. Echo 5-1. And you're talking to Rarotonga, which is, wow, it's way out there. It's 20 miles in circumference. There's 10,000 people on the island. They got a golf course. Who knew? Anyway, it's an interesting place. But all this has made me think that I need some sort of directional antenna for the DR, but I'm wary about doing it because of lightning and winds. So we'll have to see. Hey, listen, I want to confess to something here, perhaps to the authorities. When we were getting ready to leave the Dominican Republic, I turned to Elisa and I said, "The beacon transmitter, should I turn it off or should I leave it on?" And she, not knowing anything about radio, she just said, "Oh, leave it on. What the heck?" So I said, "Okay," and I left it on. Now, I do have remote control ability to turn it off at any time. I can call up the maid at the house and say, "Go and press that button I told you about and turn the thing off." So in that sense,
You're a
okay,
control
I'm the
operator.
control operator all the
Yeah.
time.
Yes.
Anyway, the beacon is chirping away, and I've actually heard it here once, and it's been picked up. Conditions have been bad for the last week or so, but it has been picked up by the reverse beacon network. One other thing I want to mention that I did down there was that I brought with me the General Electric converted CB radio. Dean has the JCPenney version.
I
I
do.
brought the General Electric one with me, and I left it down there. And on one quiet afternoon down there, I said to myself, I bet you I can make a contact with this thing. It's 5 watts AM on 29 megahertz. The antenna is a quarter wave vertical. I noticed that conditions on 10 were pretty good. I fired it up. I worked a station in the UK, G3YPZ, with this thing, 10 meters AM, less than 5 watts, quarter wave vertical. Boom. Anyway, it was great fun. I made the contact with that.
I have never made a contact with it, Bill. I've heard some stations, but I've never managed to actually make a contact.
You've got to try to make one contact. Wait till 10 meters is in good shape. Anyway, that's all I have. That's all I have to report. Guys, I think it's time for the mailbag. We've got
Hey,
some.
before you go into the mailbag, I want to pogo stick on something you mentioned about mostly DIY RF.com in the
Go
toss
ahead,
board.
Pete.
That's the intent of the minimalist transceiver that I'm building, is to use Todd's board so you don't have to go looking for a bunch of stuff. So in the final piece of this, I'll circle which boards you can use to build in that transceiver so you don't have to worry about surface mount. That's why I said you could do it with Manhattan style construction,
Yeah,
because most of
I've
the
used
parts
these.
he's got.
Yeah, I've used the boards, the Tia amp boards, just the same way that Dean used his too, and I didn't feel bad
They're
about
about the
it at
size of
all.
your thumb.
They really reduce the amount of the footprint of a Tia amp there on the board. If you try to homebrew them Manhattan style, they're big. Believe me, if
And you
you.
got to turn them around to do the other side. Remember that, Bill?
I did. I flipped them around.
You
It
flipped
connected
them around,
inputs
yeah.
to outputs. Yeah, it's great stuff. All right, good idea. Hey, listen, on mailbag, Solder Smoke mailbag. One thing I want to point out is that we've had a breakthrough on SSB for the QMX transceiver. This is Hans Sommer's QRP Labs transceiver, and it's been great on CW, great on SSB. It's multi-band, but Hans has been struggling with and working on the software that'll allow this transceiver to be used on SSB. Apparently, there's been a breakthrough. And Bob, who's a friend of mine here in Northern Virginia, has gotten a hold of the software and is working on it. So, anybody who wants to see what's going on with this, just go to the QRP Labs website, go to QMX, and you could take a look at the software there, I think,
Yeah,
also.
he's calling it a beta version of the software. So he has been working on this
Years.
transceiver for years.
I know,
So
I know. And it's important too, because some of the others who claim to have done it produce software that doesn't sound great. It doesn't. Hold on a second. I gotta have that. And anyway, apparently this stuff does, and he's produced samples with it. It sounds really good. So congratulations to Hans on that. And it's an interesting development. Hey, we got new stickers. Look at the sticker here. Look at that, man.
awesome.
Look at that. And it says right on the front of it, if you know stuff, you could do stuff. That's a quote from our friend Pete Giuliano right here. There's a QR code in there. It works like a charm. There's a
Brought us into
QR
the 21st century. Yeah.
code, everything else. This is produced by Roy, WN3F. He's got the new stickers. I've got one of them on the bottom of the show notes. Thanks for sending that, Roy. Roy also built a direct conversion receiver. Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for doing that, Roy. Hope you had a good time with it. Roger, Papa Alpha One, Zulu Zulu over in Holland. He sent us a video about capacitors replacing batteries in French electrical bicycles. Interesting idea. We'll have to see about that. Walter KA4KXX, he has given lots of help on the direct conversion receiver project. But you know what? I don't know if you spotted this, Dean. Walter, KA4KXX does not have an oscilloscope.
I saw that.
It's just sad. It's just wrong. Something's wrong with that. We've got to do something about that. Let's think about that. Walter, whether you know it or not, you need one. You need to be able to look at that waveform. Yeah. Even the guys on the DC receiver who've never homebrewed before, how many of them went out and bought scopes right off the bat? A
A
lot of
bunch
them.
of them did, yeah.
A lot of them,
And you
yeah.
get a hell of a scope for a little money.
I
Yeah,
know the digital.
they're very accessible. But this gets into the boat anchor thing, Bill. At Winterfest, there were stacks of Tektronix scopes sitting there being
I know
unsold.
because everybody's gone Regal. I mean, one of the guys on the DC receiver project was asking about whether he should spend his money on a tech scope or get the Regal scope. And I just said Regal.
Yeah, there you
I was
go.
watching PBS Nova last night, and they were talking about really advanced physics, how they were doing, GPS timing and everything like that. And they did a shot of the lab, and in there's the scope, Regal. All right. Let's see. Aaron, ZL1AUN, he's another direct conversion receiver builder, and he's been asked by the publishers of Break-In, which is the New Zealand amateur radio magazine, to do an article on the direct conversion receiver that we did. And he did that. And then so we're looking forward to the publication of that. I got a nice email from Farhan, VU2ESE, who was one of the inspirations for this receiver. And Farhan sent a really nice message when I sent him the link to the honor roll, to Hall of Fame, where you could see a report, a video of every single one of the 50 receivers that have been built. And he responded, quote, "They have mastered the alchemy of turning lifeless components into living and breathing radios.
Here you
May
go.
the tribe grow." That's it. That's it. That's why we wanted to make this a homebrew project. That's why this is different from a Heathkit. That's why this is not like IKEA. This is different. And we're glad that people appreciate that, and we really appreciate that comment from Farhan.
You know, Bill, you're going to find that that's not just a one and done. The direct conversion receiver that I published in Spratt over 3 years ago, I still get emails about someone starting to build it. So you're gonna, this is just the initial wave. You're gonna
That's
see
it.
this for years to come.
Absolutely, yeah. And this is why it's so good that all those docs that Dean produced are going to remain on the internet and available. And so it's another example of how, as much as we complain about the internet and the World Wide Web and algorithms and all that, it's still the gift that keeps on giving. Because this is how I met Pete. This is how Dean met us. Because I met Pete because I remember looking through Sprat magazine. I said, "Wow, who is this? This guy is so smart. He's over there in Newberry Park, California." And the next thing I was in touch with them. And then, boom, here we are. And then Dean got his start with us with the Michigan Mighty Mite that I sent in violation of U.S. postal regulations. Anyway,
We have 400 folks who have joined our Discord server now.
that's
So
excellent. One of them is Ramakrishnan, VU2JXN. Ramakrishnan, it's appropriate at this point that we mention him because he is one of the first solder smoke listeners. But way back when, I remember him sending me the message about the birth of his daughter. And I think she's going to college now. So it's been a while.
wow.
And anyway, Ramakrishnan is working on the direct conversion receiver. And I'm really glad that he is because we need an Indian version of this receiver. Ramakrishnan is going to build us the Indian version. He's under a lot of pressure from work right now, so he can't do it as fast as he would like. But we look forward to the Indian version of the DC receiver. Thank you, Ramakrishnan. Grayson KJ7UM. I wrote to Grayson and I said, "Hey, people, because Dean set up a tube version, because some of the guys on the Discord channel for the DC receiver expressed an interest in tube type equipment, which we found really kind of surprising. But there it is, and we're certainly not going to discourage that. So Dean set up like a tube version." And wouldn't you know it, they started talking about Grayson's book, Hollow State Design for the Radio Amateur, which is an excellent book. And I sent him a kind of a clip, a screenshot of the discussion of his book. So I hope it catches on. I suspect it will. I mentioned Mike
So
WN2A.
our Bill, our Discord channel is called Thermotron Valves and Tubes.
Thermotron, that's right, because Grayson insists on the use of the term thermotrons. And when sometimes we get people complain, they write in and say, "I don't like the word thermotron." But well, we don't pay any attention to them. We just call it th
That's
that
right.
redoubles our commitment to the term thermotron. So that's thermotrons,
Say
right? Okay.
one trick, Bill, with the using thermotrons and direct conversion receivers. Put DC on the filaments. Don't
That's
put
it.
AC. Don't put AC on the
Or else
filaments
you get a
because you'll
hum
get
like
the
crazy.
hum.
You get a hum. No, we don't want that. Good point, Pete. Mike WN2A sent the keyer for the beacon, and he sent good advice on the diplexer. We've been talking about that. Thank you for that, Mike. Alan W2AEW, who is one of our real heroes, one of our gurus, one of the stellar producers of video. He has achieved with the direct conversion receiver the joy of oscillation, JOO. And actually, because it's a variable oscillator, I think it's JOVO, joy of variable oscillation. We are
So
waiting for more.
I wrote to Alan as part of my Yaesu, I guess I should call it kind of a KK4DAS Mistbuster-like receiver. When I first built the BFO, I was trying to, what I always do when I build a transistor circuit is first, having learned from you guys, check the DC bias. Make sure you got DC at all the right places. I did that, and the DC measurements were making no sense at all on this BFO. The emitter was higher than the base. It wasn't, I didn't have the standard diode drop. And I wrote to Alan, and he was in a hotel somewhere on business. He wrote me back immediately, said, "You can't measure DC voltage on a transistor that's oscillating." I'm like, ah.
That'll do it.
And this circuit is such a good oscillator that even with everything disconnected, if I just touch the scope to the base of the transistor, it oscillates. And I knew because I've had I just the DMM probe because I had the scope hooked up on it. So thank you, Alan.
Thank you, Alan, and we look forward to reports of the successful completion of the DC receiver at W2AEW. We're sure it's on its way soon. Mike WU2D frequently checks into the old military radio net, and he has done a series of videos on the FT101, on the restoration of the FT101. His son is making coils for old radios, and I've got a link on the show notes to the eBay channel for his son, who's producing these kind of coils that'll be of use to many, many listeners here. So thanks for sending that to us, Mike. Here, Buzz W3EMD. Buzz is a real old-time radio amateur. I run into him on the old military radio net. He operates out of the Hudson Valley in New York. His receiver that he uses is a BC348 with an SDR hooked into the IF chain.
Oh, there you go.
That is like the best of both worlds right there.
Wow. Something old, something new.
It's an excellent mashup. It's great. And he's got an R13 transmitter. On the BC348, he runs it off a dynamotor.
Yeah, inside. It fits right inside. It plugs
And you
in.
can hear it when he keys the transmitter. I love it. I love it. It's always great. I love to hear Buzz's dynamotor. I heard it all the way in the Dominican Republic by a web SDR. It adds a certain amount of class to the use of the BC348. However, Buzz told me that somebody complained to him about the noise that the dynamotor was making. Pete's got a very serious look on his face right now. I think he's thinking about calling up Uncle Carmine at this point.
Yeah, Uncle Carmine, yes.
Uncle Carmine could deal with whoever
Yes.
complained about Buzz's diet. Because I think we could sum it up by just saying Pete knows a guy.
I know a guy.
You know a guy who could take care of that. Pete,
Yeah.
what would you do to that fella's coax?
Cut it. Put a pin in it
A pin in a coax.
so you couldn't see it.
All right, but it was good to hear Buzz. W2DAB, Dave. Dave is the guy who called up the HP 8640B signal generator from me when Steve Silverman moved out of Lower Manhattan. Dave lives in the Upper East Side, and he went down and carried this thing. It's a huge piece of gear. It's heavy, up to his apartment on the Upper East Side, where we picked it up weeks later. But Dave is working on the DC receiver. I told him we need a New York City Upper East Side receiver built. So we're sure that's going to be coming. Phil, W1PJE, He's the guy at MIT. And man, we were really thrilled when we heard there was going to be an MIT DC receiver. Phil has been sidetracked, understandably. He's got some work-related problems that he's attempting to deal with, so we understand completely about the delay. Hang in there, Phil. Thanks. We look forward to the receipt of news on your receiver. Jeff Dam, WA7MLH,
Roadkill.
one of the collaborators on Solid State Design for Radio Amateurs, a very close friend of Wes Hayward, wrote asking about. He asked some general questions about what we were talking about before, about the amount of interest in the internet on homebrew radio, and I tried to give him an honest, candid assessment of the fact that there are probably very few people who are interested in our little niche. But he's the one who sent me the one about, you'll see on the show notes, the old guy who's screaming and said, "When we were kids, we had to homebrew our own gear and we liked it." So thank you for that, Jeff. I got a nice email from Wes, W7ZOI. It's always good to hear from him. And finally, we got an email from Dave, AA7EE. Dave produces probably the most beautiful homebrew gear you've ever seen. His photography is excellent. His construction is flawless. He makes great use of the Mi pads from Maine. And he sent in a comment. He really liked the regen construction of Armin, WA1UQO, who's another big fan of the solder smoke community. And I just put that in there, and Armin was really pleased that Dave liked his rigs.
No, Dave's rigs are works of art. You don't even want to fire them up. You just want to look at them.
Just look at him. They're just terrific. I wish he would do more of them. He has been sort of absent from the internet. Dave, make some more rigs. Just take pictures of them. Put them on
And
there.
in fact, we know a direct conversion receiver that would look really good with that treatment.
Ooh, there's an idea. There's an idea. One with a screw-in PTO. Yeah, there you go. And I can actually give the steel. I have an extra steel screw, 28 pitch.
And I have a 3D printed PTO form.
Well, Dave, the gauntlet is on the ground, my friend. And wait a second, let me hold it up here. When you know stuff, you can do stuff.
Yeah.
Guys, that's it. I think this is a wrap for the podcast. Any final comments? Nope. Okay. Well, listen, 7-3 is from Northern Virginia.
7-3 to the left coast.
And 7-3 is from the new Solder Smoke Maryland headquarters of my Eastern Shore villa. This is where I am on the Eastern Shore of the Chesapeake Bay. No radios here yet. It's not a shack yet, but it will be.
But we're tri-state. We're tri-state. All right. Excellent. Thanks.
International and tri-state.
Thanks, guys. 7-3.
7-3s.